And now, without further ado, let's welcome our guest author, Wally Lamb.
Thank you, Margaret, and thank you, Dreadnought. That was the coolest music I've heard in about, five and a half years, something like that. Well, I can't see any of you, but I know you're out there. I was a high school teacher for about 25 years, and this is one heck of a big study hall. Here's my game plan. I thought I would tell you a little bit about myself, a little bit about this novel, and then read some sections of it. And without further ado, let me tell you that if you say Connecticut, you're likely to conjure in people's minds images of leafy bedroom towns whose Tony residents commute to Manhattan, unwind at the country club, and send their kids to prep school. But I come from the other Connecticut. I come from east of the Connecticut River, Connecticut. We're more feisty than fashionable. We're more liverwurst than pate. Boston exerts a greater pull on us than New York, and so we drop our R's, root for the Sox, and use the word wicked as an adverb, as in this sentence. Sounds familiar, right? Here's an example of the way we Eastern Connecticut people talk. For the last stop on my book tour, I've come to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where everybody's wicked good looking. As I say, I can't see any of you, but I know that's true. Norwich, the eastern Connecticut mill town where I was born and raised, is the prototype for Three Rivers, the fictional town where I've now set two of my novels. Dominic and Thomas Birdsey, and I know this much is true, and Calum Quirk, the protagonist of The Hour I First Believe, were classmates as kids, baby boomers raised by their working class families and by TV, Howdy Doody, Shindig, All in the Family, The News. Each evening after supper, avuncular Walter Cronkite delivered the daily rise and fall, the worrisome advances of communists and cosmonauts, the rise, the Elvis and Beatles and hula hoop crazes, the assassination in Dallas, blood spilled in the South for a righteous cause and in Vietnam for a dubious one, the Birdsey brothers and Calum Quirk were shaped by turbulent times, the tube, and an Eastern Connecticut sensibility. And so was I. I was 30 when I wrote my first short story, and I've been writing fiction now for about 27 years. In 1992, the phone rang, and the caller on the other end claimed that she was Oprah Winfrey. Yeah, right, I remember thinking. You're Oprah Winfrey, and I'm Geraldo Rivera. But it really was she. Oprah was calling to thank me for having written my then-just-published first novel, She's Come Undone. I couldn't stop reading it. She said, you owe me two nights' sleep. She called me again in 1997 to say that she had started a new feature on her show to promote the pleasures and the challenges of reading. And so She's Come Undone became the third book chosen for the phenomenally popular Oprah's Book Club. And then the following year, I Know This Much Is True, became an Oprah Book Club selection, too. And these endorsements of my work have been both a boon and a blessing. And Oprah's philosophy to take what you need and then pass on the rest to others, well, that's guided me, too. As I've received, I've tried to give back as generously as I can. And that resolution was what led me to my volunteer work at York Prison. That's Connecticut's maximum security facility for women. To date, my writing students there, as Margaret mentioned, have published two collections of their autobiographical essays, Couldn't Keep It to Myself and I'll Fly Away. Now, I have to tell you, the hour I first believed, I had a terrible time starting this book. A year's worth of promising beginnings fizzled into false starts. I had a waiting readership, a book contract, a deadline, and no story. And in the midst of this creative drought, I agreed to teach a writing seminar at the Tennessee Williams Festival in New Orleans. And it was my first visit to that city, and I mostly avoided the conference socializing in favor of walking the streets alone. And my wandering and my despondency led me into St. Louis Cathedral on busy Jackson Square in the city's French Quarter. Now, outside there was revelry, jugglers, street musicians, dancing, lots of drinking. But the cavernous church was empty. And in my forlorn state, I lit a candle and knelt and prayed to, well, I don't know who or what exactly. The muse, maybe, or the gods, or the ghost of Tennessee Williams. Whoever or whatever you are, I said, please help me to discover a story. And shortly after that trip, I began the novel in earnest. This was the first sentence that my character, then nameless, then identityless, spoke to me. It's not the first sentence of the novel, but it's the first sentence of his that I heard. Calum said, my mother was a convicted felon, a manic depressive, and Miss Rheingold of 1950. Now, in the 9 years it's taken me to construct the novel, the ground, of course, has shifted beneath all of us. School shootings, 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, the protracted wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and, of course, Sarah Palin. These have altered us collectively and as individuals. And it became important for me to take on some of this stuff. And so I think this novel probably in many ways is a reflection of what our lives have been like over the past 8-9 years and where we started and where we've come. Now, the year that I began the story, our two elder sons were a college freshman and a high school freshman, and our youngest was in third grade. Today, our third grader is 18, and his older brothers are both teachers. And they work with the storm-tossed kids of the inner city of New Orleans. And because it's an irony that always strikes me, because I believe that that's where the story truly began, way before either of my sons landed there. Whenever I visit them in the Big Easy, I make it a point somewhere during the good times to separate and go back to St. Louis Cathedral, where I give thanks to that greater power, whoever or whatever, that allowed me finally to find and tell the story. And as of about 3-4 weeks ago, it was not my story anymore. It was your story. And I invite all of you to find in it whatever you need or want to find. I just hope that the book advances the notion that power must be used responsibly and mercifully, and that we're all responsible for one another. Now, I'm going to read you a couple of very short segments in the voice of Calum Quirk, and I'm going to read the first couple of paragraphs of that novel. Calum, as the story opens, is 47 years old. He's disaffected and disconnected. He's blown his way through two bad marriages, and his third marriage is failing. He's a highly imperfect guy. One day while I was writing as Calum, suddenly he said a sentence that really helped to define me. Define him, rather. He said, oh, come on now, you didn't hear that. Calum said, ask any of us cynical bastards to lift up our shirt and we can show you where we got shot in the heart. And how Calum and I differ is that I am not cynical, and he, at the opening of the story, is cynical and has to learn how to drop away that cynicism. I believe cynics are really wounded idealists. This is Calum in the opening lines of the novel. They were both working their final shift at Blackjack Pizza that night, although nobody but the two of them realized it was that. Give them this much. They were talented secret keepers, patient planners. They'd been planning it for a year, hiding their intentions in plain sight, on paper, on videotape, over the internet. In their junior year, one had written in the other's yearbook, "God, I can't wait until they die. I can taste the blood now." And the other had answered, "Killing enemies, blowing up stuff, killing cops. My wrath will be godlike. My wrath will be godlike." Maybe that's a clue. Maybe their ability to dupe everyone was their justification. If we could be fooled, then we were all fools, and they were therefore superior, chaos theirs to inflict. But I don't know. I'm just one more chaos theorist, as lost in the maze as everyone else. Now, Calum is a teacher at Columbine High School, and his wife Maureen is a school nurse there. On the day of the tragedy, Calum is not at the school. He has flown back east to tend to his ailing aunt. And Maureen is not only at the school, but she's at the epicenter. She's been working in the library with a troubled student named Velvet, who becomes a major character in the novel. And in the midst of that work that they're doing at the library, Maureen excuses herself. She said, "You know, I really want to go and call my husband to see how he's doing." And she goes to the librarian's break room, and she hears the first explosion while she's on the phone. And she assumes that it's in the chemistry lab at Columbine on the second floor, just down from the library was the science wing. And then she hears the screaming, and she realizes what's happening. And she drops into the fetal position, and she crawls into a cabinet in the librarian's break room. And she survives the slaughter. And when she comes out, she's damaged by it. She's one of the collaterally damaged of Columbine, and begins to wrestle with post-traumatic stress disorder that becomes a more serious case of PTSD that segues to addiction to painkillers and so forth. And Calum, for the first time in these three marriages, reaches out and begins to learn how to become a good husband. The problem is that his wife is sort of abandoned on this island of grief. This is Calum a little bit later in the story. "In the days, weeks, and months, and years now since they opened fire, I've searched wherever I could for the whys, hows, and whether or nots of Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold's rampage. They had been my students first, but I became theirs, stalking them so that I might rescue my wife from the aftermath of what they had done. On that day, Maureen had escaped execution by opening a cabinet door and entering a maze, a many-corridored prison whose four outer walls were fear, anger, guilt, and grief. And because I was powerless to retrieve her, because I too entered the labyrinth and became lost, my only option was to find its center and confront the two-headed monster who waited for me there and murder it. Murder the murderers who had already murdered themselves. You see what a puzzler it was? What a network of dead ends? Well, like I said, I was lost." Now, I'm going to change the pace a little bit, and I'm going to ask you to use your imagination. I realize that you probably have not encountered a whole lot of bald and bearded eight-year-olds, but I'm going to be reading for a compressed version of Chapter 4, in which I allow Calum's childhood voice to speak. So this is Calum as a young man. He's a third grader. "Sometimes my scary dreams are about Daddy, and sometimes they're about Mr. Zadzilko. Our school used to have a different janitor, Mr. Mapipi, but he got fired. And I was mad because Mr. Mapipi was nice. The teachers think that Mr. Zadzilko's nice, too, because he brings them these stupid donuts that his mother makes called punchkis. But Mr. Zadzilko is not nice. When the teachers go to the toilet, he peeks at them through his secret hole. Before Mr. Mapipi got fired, he came to our class once, and he told us about these people called the Bushmen that are his relatives or his ancestors or something. And he showed us where they live on the world map, in Africa, near the bottom. And you know what? Bushmen hunt and eat jackals and desert rats. And when they see a praying mantis, they think it's God. Mr. Mapipi had our class all sit on the floor, even Miss Hogan. And us kids sat cross-legged, but Miss Hogan knelt on her knees and her skirt made a big circle around her. And Mr. Mapipi told us a story about how Mantis made the moon by throwing fire into the night sky and how he married a snake. And he talked his bushman talk with these little clicky noises before the words. And everybody laughed, even Miss Hogan. And Mr. Mapipi laughed too, and he has this high, squealy laugh. Mr. Mapipi is colored, I think, except he doesn't have chocolate skin. It's more orangey, like the dried apricots that Grandpa eats. After his visit, our class wrote Mr. Mapipi a thank you letter on big easel paper, and we all signed it. And it made him so happy that he gave us a present, a praying mantis egg case. And it was supposed to hatch in April, but it didn't. And then after the assembly, Mr. Mapipi got fired. And Miss Hogan was going to throw out the egg case, but I asked her if I could have it. She said yes, and so I brought it home and put it on my windowsill. I caught Mr. Zadzilko peeking. That's how come I know about the hole. It's in the big second floor closet where the buckets and the mops and the spick and span are. Miss Hogan wrote me a pass, and she sent me down to help him because I was the first one done with my social studies questions, and I had ants in my pants and was bothering my neighbors. I opened the closet door, and Mr. Zadzilko was peeking through the hole, and he jumped when he saw me, and he fixed his pants, and he was laughing like, oh, geez, look at this. The mop handle must have poked a hole in the wall. I got to patch this when I get a free minute. He gave me a sponge and told me to wet it in the boys' room and go downstairs and wipe the cafeteria tables. And after, when the recess bell rang, I went back upstairs to return my sponge. And Mr. Zadzilko wasn't there, so I turned a bucket upside down, and I climbed up and looked through the hole. And there was the principal, Miss Anderson, sitting on the toilet, and she was smoking a cigarette. And you could see her girdle. I knew it was naughty to look, and so I closed my eyes, and I got down off the bucket. And when I turned toward the door, Mr. Zadzilko was standing there. Well, my, he said, aren't you the dirty boy? He yanked the pull chain and the closet light went on, and then he pulled the door closed behind him. And he came over and sat down on the bucket so that he was whispering right in my face. The hole was a secret between me and him, he said. And if I said anything, he was going to tell the teachers that he caught me looking. Hey, you were just curious, he said. I understand that, but they won't. They'll probably have you arrested. And then everybody's going to know that you're the dirty boy. He reached behind him and he took a greasy paper bag off the shelf and he opened it and held it out for me. Here, he said, help yourself. And I reached in and pulled out one of those donut things that his mother makes. They're called punchkis, he said. Take a bite. They're delicious. I didn't want to, but I did. What are you, a little mouse nibbling on a crumb? Come on, take a bigger bite. And so I did, and the stuff inside looked like bloody nose. What kind did you get? Prune? He said, oh, no, raspberry. Yeah, that's my favorite, too. What are you shaking for, dirty boy? And I tried to stop shaking, but I couldn't because he kept looking at me. You know what punchki means, right? In Polish? I shook my head. It means little package because the donut makes a little package around the stuff that's inside of it. You see? Oh, I said, yeah. Can I go now? It's recess. Like us men may carry the stuff that's inside of us in our sacks. You get it? I didn't know what he was talking about, but I nodded. Well, you don't look like you get it. Point to where your punchki's at. What? Your little package. Where is it, dirty boy? Point to it for me. I could hear kids playing outside, but they sounded farther away than just the playground, and I was trying not to cry. Mr. Zadzilko made an O with his thumb and his pointing finger. Here's the woman's hole, you see, otherwise known as her snatch. And he leaned closer and he dropped his hand down. And this, my dirty boy, this is where your little package is at. And he flicked his finger hard and it hurt. It's recess, I said. I'm supposed to go. Oh, well, then go then. But you just remember what happens to dirty boys who have big mouths. The hallway was empty, and there was laughing coming out of the teacher's room. And I went downstairs to the boys' room. I hadn't swallowed that bite he made me take. I hit it against my cheek. And so I spit it into the toilet, and I threw the rest of my punchki in after it. And I kept flushing, and it kept swirling around and looking like it was going to go down, and then it would bob back up again. And by the time I got out onto the playground, I had a stomachache. And then the recess bell rang 2 seconds later, and we all had to go in. And that night, I was lying in bed thinking about Mr. Zadzilko, and Mother came into my room in the dark. "Kayla," she said, "are you asleep or awake?" And I didn't answer for a long time, and then finally I said, "Awake." "Did I hear you crying in here? What were you crying about?" And I almost told her, but then I didn't. "I was thinking about Jesus dying on the cross," I said, "and it made me sad." I knew Mother would like that answer. Mother goes to Mass every morning before work, and that's why she can't get me ready for school. So Aunt Lolly gets me ready once she finishes morning milking. Except if there's a problem, she calls me from the barn phone, and I have to get myself ready and not dawdle, or else I'll miss the bus. And one time, some of our cows got loose and started running up Bride Lake Road, and Aunt Lolly had to go get them because they could have got hit by a car. Except she forgot to call me, and I started watching Captain Kangaroo, which I'm not supposed to watch TV in the morning. And then the bus came, and I was still in my pajamas, and Mother had to leave work and drive back to the farm and drive me to school, and she was crying and yelling because now Mr. McCulley probably wouldn't pick her to be head teller, thanks to me. And at the stop signs and the red lights, she kept reaching over and whacking me. And by the time we got to school, we were both crying. And I had to roll the window down and air out my eyes before I went in because the school does not need to know about our private family business. On Saturdays, Mother vacuum cleans the priest's house for free. And she takes home their dirty clothes and pillowcases because Monsignor Guglielmo is helping her get annulled. And after Sunday dinner, Mother irons the priest's clothes and then she drives them back. And if she finishes in time, then we can go to the movies. My favorite movie is Old Yeller, except for that part where Travis has to shoot Old Yeller because he gets hydrophobia. And Mother's favorite movie is The Song of Bernadette. She says Jesus sends messages to the boys that he picks to become priests and that I should always look and listen for signs. "What kind of signs?" I said. "Well, it could be anything. A voice, a vision in the sky." One time I saw a cloud that looked like a man with a big Jimmy Durante nose. When I sing Inca Dinka Doo with my Jimmy Durante voice, the grown-ups always laugh. And at the end, I go, "Good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are." And they clap and tell me, "Do it again, do it again." But Mother never laughs. And she says that Jimmy Durante cloud was not a sign from Jesus. I told Mother that the Bushmen think that God is a praying mantis. And she said, "Well, that is just plain silly." Miss Hogan at my school, she used to be our second grade teacher. Now she's our third grade teacher on account of she switched grades. And I'm glad because Miss Hogan is nice, and plus she's pretty. She drives a green Studebaker, and she likes cats instead of dogs. I mean, I like her, but I don't love her or anything. Miss Hogan's fiancé, Mr. Foster, used to play football at Fordham University, and now he's a cameraman at a television studio in New York City. And Miss Hogan's favorite TV show is I've Got a Secret, because that's the show where Mr. Foster works at. And you know what? When Mr. Foster visited that time, Rhonda Bunce in our class raised her hand and she said, "Can you and Miss Hogan kiss for us?" And she had to go stand in the cloakroom until recess. One time during vacation week, Mother let me stay up and watch I've Got a Secret. And one man's secret was he got struck by lightning and he did not even die. And another man had this long, long beard. And his secret was that at night, he slept with his whiskers inside the covers, not outside. And they guessed the whiskers guy, but not the lightning guy. Oh, and last year, one of our best milkers got struck by lightning. Dolly, her name was. And you know what the vet said? He said that Dolly's heart exploded. And Grandpa had to bulldoze her across the road and down to the gravel pit. And all week long, vultures kept flying over our south field. I've got a secret. Somebody in our grade keeps spitting in the drinking fountain in the main hallway. And Miss Hogan thinks that it's Thomas Birdsey, but it's not. It's me. And last week, our whole class was not allowed to get a drink until somebody admitted that they were the spitter. And everyone got madder and madder at Thomas because he wouldn't admit it. And even I got kind of mad at him because I was thirsty and I kind of forgot who the real secret spitter was. And then Thomas made a load in his pants the way he used to in first grade, and the office made his mother come and get him. And our whole classroom stunk. And Miss Hogan had to send in for Mr. Zadzilko, and we all went outside and played dodgeball. And then after, when we came back into the building, Miss Hogan let everybody get drinks. In the hallway, Mr. Zadzilko is always looking at me, and I want to say, "What are you looking at, Mr. Big Fat Glasses Face?" I don't, though. I just look away. And sometimes when I try to hand in my paper early, Miss Hogan goes, "It's not a race, Calum. You go back to your desk and check your work." And if I check my work and I'm still waiting for everybody and distracting the other kids, that's when I have to take the pass and go help Mr. Zadzilko. And after Mr. McCulley did pick Mother to be head teller, now she always has to stay late at the bank because of her extra responsibilities. And she won't let me go on the bus because Aunt Lolly's already working over at the prison and Grandpa's getting ready for milking. Except she doesn't pick me up until way, way after all the other kids go home. See, she had a talk with Miss Anderson about letting me stay and wait, and Miss Anderson lets me because Mother's divorced. And sometimes I get to stay in our room with Miss Hogan, and sometimes I have to go and be Mr. Zadzilko's helper. And he has me clap erasers and empty the waste baskets into the big barrel in the hallway or wipe down the blackboards with a big sponge. And one time after an assembly, I had to go to the auditorium and help him fold all the folding chairs. And we stacked them on these flat carts that have wheels. And you know where all the folding chairs go? Under the stage. This door, I never even noticed, opens and the chairs roll in on carts and they stay there until the next assembly. After the United Nations Assembly, that was when Mr. Mapipi got fired, after he did his dance. First, Miss Anderson gave a speech about the UN, and then the fourth graders sang Around the World in 80 Days, and then some lady who went on a trip to China showed us her China slides. And Anthony Chianji started tickling me, and Miss Hogan made us sit between her and Miss Anderson. And the China lady talked so long that the projector melted one of her slides. And the sixth graders started clapping. Mr. Mapipi came on near the end, and he walked out on the stage, and instead of his janitor clothes, he was wearing this big red cape and no shoes. And he told everybody about how the Bushmen hunted jackals and prayed to their praying mantis god, and he talked that clicky talk. And the sixth graders started being rude. It's okay if you're laughing with somebody, but not if you're laughing at them, except Mr. Mapipi thought that everyone was laughing with him, so he started laughing too. That high, squealy laugh of his, and it made things worse, and Miss Anderson had to stand up and give the sixth graders a dirty look. Mr. Mapipi said he was going to show us two Bushmen dances, the dance of the great hungering and the dance of love, but he was not going to stop in between, he said. One dance was just going to turn into the other dance, because what does all of us hunger for, he asked. And no one in the audience said anything, and so Mr. Mapipi waited, and then finally he said, "We hunger for love." Well, he untied his cape, and he dropped it on the floor, and all he was wearing was this kind of diaper thing. I saw Miss Anderson and Miss Hogan look at each other, and Miss Anderson said, "Good God in heaven." Mr. Mapipi was shouting and yipping and doing this weird shaky dance, and he had a pot belly and a big behind, and the sixth graders were laughing so hard they were falling off their chairs. And then somebody yelled, "Shake it, Sambo." And Mr. Mapipi kept dancing, but Miss Anderson walked over and she started flicking the auditorium lights on and off, and then she went up on the stage and handed Mr. Mapipi his cape and said that the assembly was over. "I would like everyone except the sixth graders to proceed in an orderly fashion back to their rooms," she said. And later, during silent reading, Miss Hogan had me bring a note down to Miss Anderson's office. And her door was closed, but I could hear Mr. Mapipi in there. And he was saying, "But why I'm fired, Mrs. Principal? Please say the why." When the teachers are around, Mr. Zadzilko is all nice to me, and he calls me his best helper and stuff. But when it's just me and him, he calls me Dirty Boy, and he keeps flicking his finger at me down there. That's to remind you that if you ever blab about certain things, I'm going to tell everyone that little Dirty Boy likes to look at his teacher's twats. And I think he means their girdles. One time I had a scary dream that Daddy was giving me a ride in a helicopter, and we were flying over our farm, and he said, "Hang on, something's wrong, we're going to crash." And then I woke up. And in this other scary dream, I had Mr. Zadzilko grab me, and he put me in the dark space under the stage where the folding chairs go. And he locked that little door, and nobody knew I was in there, and every time I tried to scream, nothing came out. Mr. Zadzilko told me he killed a dog once, And he did it by tying a rope around the dog's neck and throwing the other end over a tree branch and yanking. You ought to have seen the way that dog was dancing, he said. You got a dog, don't you, dirty boy? I said, no, I didn't. Yeah, you do. He's brown and white. I seen him that time my mother and me drove out to your farm for cider. Well, maybe if Dirty Boy tells certain secrets, his dog will have to get the Stanzad Zilko rope treatment. How come you have a mother and no wife, I said. And he got all red and told me that was his business. And then, last week, Miss Hogan made an announcement. We have to be extra tidy for the next several days, she said. Poor Mr. Zadzilko's mother passed away over the weekend, and he's going to be absent all week. And she passed around a card and said to make sure we all sign it in cursive and in pen, not pencil, and as neat as possible. And when the card got to me, I wrote Calum Quirk, but Mr. Glass's face probably doesn't even know what my real name is. And all day, I kept thinking about Mr. Zadzilko being absent. And after school, after I emptied our wastebasket and washed our board and was still waiting for Mother to come, I went up to Miss Hogan's desk. What is it, Calum? She said. I've got a secret. Oh, you do you? Or would you like to tell me what it is? Okay. Miss Anderson smokes. When she sits on the toilet, I seen her from Mr. Zadzilko's peeking hole. Well, for a long time, Miss Hogan just looked at me like I said it in Chinese or something. And then she got up and she took my hand and she had me show her. And you know what? The next morning when I woke up, that egg case on my windowsill had hatched. And there were these teeny tiny little praying mantises scrambling all over the sill and on the floor and even in my bed. Hundreds of them. Thousands. Millions, maybe. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be back here on Writers on New England Stage. Thanks for coming out again in the middle of a busy holiday season. And thanks, Wally Lamb. It's great to meet you.
Thank you.
If a reader walked away from reading this book, probably is going to get a lot of messages and themes and thoughts. You're tying in a lot here. But, Wally, if there was one message or one thought that you really hope readers come away with after this book, what would it be?
I think probably if I had to summarize it in a soundbite, I would say that love is stronger than hatred.
Give us a little more, Wally. There's a lot of that in there.
Well, you know, part of this sort of connects to my work with the prisoners at York. But, you know, James Baldwin once said that people who misuse power must not be surprised when the bread that they have cast on the waters comes back to them poisoned. And, you know, when I reflect on not only what I've observed in the prison, but also what I've observed in our country and in the past 8 years and internationally, you know, that really resonates with me.
How has your work at the women's prison informed your work as an author?
Oh, in many, many ways. You know, I sort of think of myself as the accidental novelist. I never really planned that this was going to happen. I just began writing one day, and I couldn't stop doing it. And nor did I plan to become an activist. So I'm an accidental activist as well. But once you get into the prison and you see what you see, you can't unsee it again. And so one of the things that the women taught me through their writing and their conversations with one another, and they're really helping one another, was how a chaotic childhood can send your life reeling in a whole different direction. And another thing that they taught me about was the devastating effects of post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, I'm seeing the military men and women come back from the war at the same time, and I'm hearing stories about their PTSD. And then one of our sons was teaching down in the Ninth Ward in New Orleans pre-Katrina, and then suddenly he was dealing with students suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. So all of these, I began to sort of connect the dots between all of these things, and it just sort of all suggested it to me. Now, the women at the prison were also great research contacts for me too. Like I would, and as I read their work and give them hopefully useful feedback, I sort of turned the tables on myself, and I read a lot of this novel in process and got feedback from them. And I would say to them, okay, I need some jail lingo. And then, I'd go back the next week, and one woman would have she would have made a glossary. And then I would say, okay, I got a guy, and he's going to be visiting his wife in the visiting room. What's that like? And they gave me, the rules for the visiting room. One woman drew an aerial map of what the visiting room looks like. So they were very generous to me. So it was a real symbiotic relationship, and still is.
And they didn't mind being your guinea pigs or being presented in one form or another in this novel?
No, because simultaneously I was editing their stories, and we never meant to write a book, but they just revised so relentlessly and became such good critics of one another that the material got publishable.
In the book, Wally, you harken back to a much better time at the Calum family's prison, mm-hmm. That their family's involved with, to an earlier time when the women were treated more as people who had some hope for rehabilitation, mm-hmm. almost treated as members of the family in a mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. And later in the novel, when Calum's wife, Maureen, ends up in the prison, and mm-hmm. I won't tell the audience how or mm-hmm. why, it's a much different environment. Mm-hmm. Is that what you have seen yourself in your own experience working at the women's prison?
Yeah.
This transition.
Right. I had to learn about that by researching. I became curious. I feel very uncomfortable about some of the rules and regulations and some of the capriciousness and the ways that the women are treated in a way that sort of ignores their human dignity. And so I got curious about what that prison had been like. It was opened up in, I think, 1915, 1916 as a penitentiary and a work farm. And it was primarily back then for city women, fallen women, as they used to call them, who had fallen prey to the ills of the big cities. So, prostitution and public drunkenness and that kind of thing. And so I went back and I read a lot of the old State of Connecticut reports and a lot of the old news articles, and I found that the irony for me is that it was a much more progressive place in those early days, and the philosophy was if you take these women and give them fresh air and sunshine in a sort of a bucolic atmosphere, and you encourage them to give back to the community, raise vegetables and fruits for the poorhouse, that kind of thing, that they will get better, that they will be rehabilitated. And it seemed to have worked. Now, back then, a family could incarcerate their daughter, and some of those early charges were wild. There was one called being in manifest danger of falling into vice, which I guess means she looks a little shaky, so, you know, so just
subjective.
In case, we're gonna imprison her. Yeah.
Is there a connection or a linkage, Wally, between the bullying and the cruelty that you describe at this women's prison and the bullying and the cruelty that the teachers see at Columbine High School?
Yes, I think bullying is that misuse of power that I've been talking about. And yes, I see it in some of the guards, certainly not all of the guards, the correctional officers at this prison, but many of them sort of misuse that power. And I think lots of times, and you know, having been a high school teacher and a high school kid way before that, I've seen not only the bullying but the effects of it. And you know, when I was teaching high school, the kids that I gravitated toward and the kids who gravitated toward me were what I sort of came to think of as the walking wounded. They're the kids for whom high school is a kind of a misery. They're not on the football team. They're not in the honor society. They're the kids who are kind of like slump postured, walking around, all dressed in black, and you know,
like velvet in the book.
They take creative writing and drama and that kind of thing, and they find their outlets in the school. But lots of times they are the targets of bullies because you know they wear their unhappiness. Now that's very different than Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris, who were really hiding in plain sight, and they were dressed very conventionally, and you know, nobody really picked up that they were as disaffected and I would say probably depraved as they were.
And I want to ask you a couple questions about Columbine, because in addition to the women's prison, that's really the other central element in this book. Mm-hmm. How challenging was it, Wally, to write fiction in this nonfiction framework, this very real event that happened and that we all watched?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the day that Columbine happened, it had been a really nice day for me. I was up in Boston with my wife, Chris, and I was going to get a nice literary award, and I was tying my necktie in the bathroom mirror of the hotel, and I heard Chris in the other room say, "Oh, my God, oh, no." And I walked out, and, you know, there was Columbine sort of unfolding. And I eventually, about, you know, not too many months after that, one day I was Googling, and I Googled school shootings. And this sort of tidal wave of stuff came back at me. And the most unnerving of that were these videos that the kids had had taped prior to the massacre, in which they're sort of laughing at everybody and for being so stupid as to not have, you know, seen that they were there and they were giving clues all along. And that, I tell you, Laura, that really messed with my head, you know, as both a teacher and also a father. It was very scary to me that they could be that masterful at that, or that they had that degree of hatred in them that they thought that they could somehow play God and mete out this horrible, what they saw as justice.
And that part of the book is really difficult to go through. You give a lot of their conversations, their journals, what happens in those videos. Have you met with any of the Columbine parents? Because you name these people by name.
Yeah. It was important to me, because Eric and Dylan had really, as I said, gotten into my head, it was important for me to take them on non-fictionally. And so I chose not to do, you know, a Columbine-like story.
It would almost be silly to do it that way.
Yeah, but that said, I had to write it as responsibly as I could, and particularly because I was using the names of the victims as well. I had in my earlier novel, I know this much is true. I had a terrible time starting that novel too, and once I finally got the first chapter, I brought it. I work in writers groups, and I brought it to my writers group, and there was an elderly woman who was working with our group at the time, and she has a mentally ill son in his 30s. And so I read this opening chapter where Dominic is talking about his schizophrenic brother, And this woman slapped her notebook shut, and she waved her finger in front of my face, and she said, "If you're going to take up this subject, then you better do it responsibly, because there's a lot of crap out there in the culture, psycho this, psycho that, and you better get it right." And then she slapped her notebook shut, and she stormed out of the place. And it was really hard to be on the receiving end of that. But ultimately, I was grateful to her for having challenged me that way. And also, I saw, her name is Feeney, I saw Feeney's hand, finger shaking itself in front of me when I started this book. Now, to get back to your question, have I run into some of the Columbine people? Yes, I've, and I'm just, this is my last stop on a pretty extensive book tour. I saved the best for last, of course. But I was nervous about going to the Denver area signings, because, you know, I tried to write it responsibly, but I couldn't assure how people are going to react to it. But people were very validating when I went there. I met one of the first responders, a woman who was on the police force, and several former students at Columbine High who went through it. And so I spoke, really nice, warm crowd, did the Q&A, and then afterwards I was signing books. And I was about maybe 50 or 60 people into the signing line when a man, middle-aged guy, comes up and he said to me, "Do you think Eric's brother Kevin should read this book?" And I didn't get it at first. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me that standing before me was the father of Eric Harris, one of the Columbine killers. And I was, you know, I've been living with these kids and their families, you know, virtually for 8 or 9 years, and I was sort of dumbfounded. I didn't know what to say, and so I just held out my hands, and Wayne Harris grabbed my hands, and we just squeezed with all of our might. And, you know, there's like 100 people waiting to have their book signed behind him, and then we, you know, our hands, we broke, and I said to him, I looked up at him and I said, "I don't have any answers for you." And he said, "I don't have any answers either." He says, "I don't know as there are any answers." And then, you know, I just very briefly gave him my email address and said, you know, if you want to talk or you want me to listen, if there are things that you want to tell me, I'll invite you to do that. And I heard from him just yesterday via email. So,
what did he say?
He said he enjoyed the talk, and he said, "Have you found any answers yet?" And I think what he was really saying, without saying it, was, let's stay open to the possibility of something. I think the families of the victims who had such horrible loss and pain were embraced by their community and by the world. But I think the Klebolds and the Harrises, who really did, as far as I could see, did nothing wrong and could not have imagined that their kids would be up to something, you know, so horrendous. I don't imagine that they had that same kind of comfort. But again, because I work with the women at the prison, and because many of them have done some pretty awful things, and yet I've learned not to be their judges, because they've already been judged. The state has judged them, and so I work very hard on not, you know, on not doing that.
Well,
so if I can be of any kind of comfort to the Harrises, then, you know, I'm willing to do that.
I have a lot more questions,
yeah,
but I also want to share some with the audience.
Sure.
With you, Wally, and again, thank you. Here's one, and I think this person who wrote this question is a woman. She says, "As I read She's Come Undone," your earlier book, "I had to keep checking that the author was a man because I couldn't believe you could understand what happens inside our heads so well." How do you explain that? And I wanted to ask you this, too. I've seen elsewhere, too, Wally, that you really kind of understand women. You get us.
Yeah. Well, part of the answer is that I grew up with sisters, and also girl cousins just two houses down from us. I like to say that the four horsewomen of the apocalypse galloped through my childhood. And my, you know, my sisters never, you know, they didn't play sports, they didn't play board games, but they were all into this sort of imaginative play. And so I'd be sort of like cast as the observer of a lot of this wild and exotic kind of behavior. And occasionally I'd be recruited for one of their games of pretend, usually in the role of victim. For instance, they invented a game called Hospital where they were nurses and they got to vaccinate me with straight pins from my mother's sewing box. In this other game, they had another game called Death Drums where they locked me in my grandmother's cannon closet. And then you wonder why I write the things that I do. And then the last game that we played together, they invented this naughty game called Kingy Boy. And I was Kingy Boy in this one. There had been this, I don't know, this bolt of pink net fabric that had come into our house for some reason. And so they wrapped a towel around my head, turban style, and I had to sit cross-legged. And they were harem girls wrapped in pink net. And they were undulating around me going, Kingy Boy, Kingy Boy. And I didn't know what the hell was going on. But at the end of the game, they said, don't tell Mom. And so instead, on my very first trip to the confessional in preparation for my first communion, I spilled the beans to Father Ziegler. I'm like, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been 0 weeks since my last confession. Here are my sins. I told a lie. I called my sister a stupid snot, and I played Kingy Boy. And Father Ziegler is like, well, all right, for your penance, I want you to say three Hail Marys and three Hail Marys, and now make the good act of, you played what? But, you know.
And he looked at you funny in church.
Right. As far as the female-male thing, I mean, you know, I don't personally subscribe to the idea that men are from Mars and women are from Venus. I mean, we all come from male and female. I think my writing group helped me to sort of sand off a lot of the, you know, I hit a lot of false notes writing as Dolores Price, but particularly the women in the group were never shy about speaking up and
saying,
oh.
Dolores Price was the character, lead character.
Right, and, oh, no, a woman, you know, a woman would never think that way. So, you know, people who read that novel are reading, you know, draft number 8,000 or something like that.
Yeah. Well, now with all due respect, Wally, you get into the heads of women. I have heard some male readers say that Calum seems kind of stereotyped. You know, he doesn't deal with his emotions. When he runs into a tough emotional situation, he just drinks and watches TV.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't...
Sound familiar?
He doesn't. You know, he has this beloved aunt, Aunt Lolly, yeah, who he loves to death. But when they talk on the phone, he says, hi, yep, how you doing? And then mm-hmm. his wife has all the in-depth yeah. conversations with Lolly.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So when Lolly finally dies, he has to call his wife and say, you know, basically, where's the cat food? You know, so he's kind of a stereotypical male there, isn't he?
And guys, aren't we all? No, I don't think he's a stereotype. I think he is a type. I think if you are raised female in our culture, you have access to all kinds of emotional outlets that guys don't necessarily have or are too afraid to take. And so, no, I don't see him as a stereotype. I see him as a typical guy who is sort of, he's living his life defensively. And he has to, over the course of the novel, learn how to break down those defenses. And he does that with some reluctance. See, what I share with my characters is that we are all imperfect people trying to become better people. And I know that Calum is not particularly likable at the beginning of the story, and I was rooting for him through the whole novel to sort of drop those defenses and become his better self. See, I never know where I'm going with my stories. I create these characters and then I become them, almost like an actor will shed his own skin and embody somebody else's skin, and I stretch and grow as a result of living my life as these people who have had a lot tougher lives than I had, whether it's Dolores and She's Come Undone, or Dominic and I Know This Much Is True, or this character. Because I don't know where the story is going, as I am speaking their voices, I'm also feeling parental toward them. And I worry about these characters. They keep me up at night, or they wake me up at night, and I don't know if they're going to be okay by the end of the story. And I don't love to write, Laura, but I love to have written, sort of like jogging, you know. But I do feel I have to keep writing because I want to know if they're going to be okay.
Here's another one from the audience. We got several along this similar theme. Mm-hmm. All of your books contain or are even centered around psychological disorders, in mm-hmm. this case, post-traumatic stress mm-hmm. disorder. How do you research these and portray them so accurately? And where does this interest come from?
The interest comes from having been raised in Norwich, Connecticut, which housed the largest state hospital for the mentally ill in the state. And it was at one time very much like the prison, and it started at about the same time as the prison, same era. It was a very progressive place. It had a beautiful campus and all these brick buildings, and they had a tannery, they had a theater, they had a baseball diamond, and so forth. And the theory was that you engage people with mental illness, and eventually they get well. When I was growing up, it was sort of turning into another type of place. And I remember riding the back of my parents' station wagon, and I was always fascinated. In Norwich, we used to call the state hospital being down below. So-and-so is down below. And which was kind of weird because it's on the top of a hill. But I remember riding by in the back of my parents' car and sort of like, you know, looking and go, ooh, there's a crazy person, you know? And it was both fascinating and scary to me. I think that's where my interest in psychology began. And as far as my research, I don't know. I didn't do any research for She's Come Undone. I Know This Much Is True I did, mainly because Feeney was shaking her finger at me. I read a lot, of course, but the best research I did with that book is person-to-person research, talking to people who have schizophrenia in their family. And it was humbling to listen to those stories and to write as the brother of somebody suffering from paranoid schizophrenia. But, man, I learned a lot, and that's because of people's generosity.
Well, you must have done a ton of research for this book, not only about Columbine, about post-traumatic stress disorder, but there's a Civil War element in mm-hmm, here, mm-hmm. And the Katrina mm-hmm. catastrophe mm-hmm. and so forth. So no wonder it took you 9 years to crank it out.
Well, with this book, my research is very internet-driven. I've talked about the videos of the Columbine kids, but also, you know how the internet can be such a great time waster, and it's sort of, you know, it's a labyrinth. One door opens on another door, and that opens on a third door, and suddenly you've been sitting there for about, you know, 2 hours that you didn't realize had gone by, and you're way off course.
And Calum does that too.
He does it as well. Yeah, and he's, and I'm sort of having this parallel thing, and it was that research that I did into the early incarnation of the prison that got me to the Civil War stuff, because one of the things I learned is that fallen women had, before the Quakers in the years after the Civil War, Quaker women brought women's penitentiaries into existence. Before that, they had just thrown them in with the men because these were disposable women. And the Quakers had been, of course, active in the abolition movement. And then after the Civil War, they sort of splintered into all these different social justice causes, one of which was to have reformatories, penitentiaries for women.
And that's the link to Calum, and that's...
It is. And, you know, I never thought about this before, but the word penitentiary comes from the word penitent. And, you know, the object then was part of the rehabilitation comes from being penitent and reflective about your life, which, in a sense, is what the women that I'm working with are doing now.
And in a sense, what the characters in this book are doing.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Here's another one from the audience that I like. Are you in every book you write? You certainly are in this one.
You think so, huh?
Well, he's a high school teacher. You're a high school teacher. He works with women at the prison. You work with women at the prison.
Right. Well, you know, there's a great writer that I know. His name is Tom Drury. And, you know, you get this question a lot in book signings and stuff. How much of you is there in your characters? And he said it way better than I could have ever done. He said, well, picture that you, there's a stained glass picture of you. It's a portrait of you. And you stand before it, and then you take a baseball bat to it, and you smash it into a million pieces. And then you sit on the floor, and you create a new picture from that. So, yeah, there are elements of me, but Calum is not me. Dominic is not me. Here's the thing that nobody seems to realize, but I'll share it with you folks. And that's that the character that I most identify with in both I Know This Much Is True and this one is Dr. Patel, the Indian psychologist who treats both Dominic and in this novel, Calum Quirk.
She's a woman.
She's a woman, but she's Indian. She's somewhat exotic. And part of the way she treats her patients is by cajoling them, jabbing them a little bit, teasing them into not taking themselves quite so seriously. And also, she has them read ancient stories, ancient myths, and as a way to sort of get them on their own quests, so to speak. And that's what I'm doing. You know, that's what I'm doing with these people that I create. I'm trying to cajole them into getting better. So there's a sort of a healing thing that's going on.
And Calum uses myth in a class he teaches at a community college,
right,
as well, and
yeah,
gets some pretty interesting stuff from his less than stellar students.
Right, his community college kids, yeah. Mm-hmm.
A couple more questions for you, if
sure.
I could, Wally. A couple of reviewers of this book have said, way too long, way too many plot lines. How do you feel about that?
Well, I do feel that that's fair. You know, you do send the book out into the world, and people can have whatever reaction that they want to have. However, I also feel that I'm not writing for literary critics. I'm writing for the general public. And it may sound selfish, but I'm writing for myself. And I think probably the fact that I sat and watched a production of Tony Kushner's amazing two-part play, Angels in America, in which he sort of goes far and wide and goes deeply into history and tries to make connections between that, you know, between many, many things. That sort of gave me the courage, as this canvas was getting wider and wider and starting to intimidate me, that gave me the courage to keep going with it. Now, I know literary critics are, you know, they're overworked. And then here comes this monster of a 700 and something page book. And it's, oh, that guy who, you know, got Oprah, you know, to sell his books for him and everything. So I can see there might be some built-in biases. I think the criticism can be fair, but I also feel that, you know, that I don't think that there are too many things. I think that there is a thread that goes through it. And if you take your time, if you're not reading a book on deadline, but you're taking your time and you're absorbing it and maybe talking to other people, I think the general readership will get all the connections.
When you put that last period on that last sentence at the end of this book, were you happy, or did you say, oh, I wish I had more time, oh, I wish I could have done a little bit more or tweaked it a little bit more?
Oh, I always feel that. You know,
you do.
One of the things that I was happy because, hey, the book hadn't killed me after all. I wasn't sure that was gonna, it was all gonna come out that way. But I never feel that my work is finished. That's why it makes me nervous when I'm at a bookstore and people are reading along with me. They bought a copy of the book, and that's why I was glad that you folks are in the dark. You can't do that. And they're reading along, and all of a sudden they look up at me as if to say, hey, that's not in here. And it's not, because sometimes I'm still fixing it, you know. It's never It's my work is never not in process. Oh, and I got to tell you this: when I did finish the novel, I have a great assistant. He's a grad student, and he's become a good friend. His name is Aaron. And so when I was near finishing the novel, I had about maybe 2 more hours to go, I figured. I said to my wife, Chris, I said, go get Aaron. And I said, when I'm finished, I'll read the last chapter to you both. And, you know, I'm a terrible judge of time and how much it's going to take. So, of course, they were waiting around. My 2 hours turned into about 4 hours. And finally, I come stumbling up from the room downstairs where I was writing. And meanwhile, well, Chris and Aaron are having a great old time, and they're laughing upstairs. I can hear them. Finally, I come upstairs, and I said, okay, I'm going to read you the last chapter. And I start reading it, and I start crying, like blubbering. And then I would read a couple more paragraphs, and then I'd start again. And then I looked over it, and the two of them are crying too. And the three of us are like sobbing away like idiots. And so anyway, finally I got to the end, and I had put some champagne in the refrigerator, and I said, okay, let's celebrate. And I go to the refrigerator, and I'm in the process of opening the cork, and I looked out, and there were 7 deer in our backyard. There were fawns, there were adult deer, and it was a beautiful irony for me, because for 9 years I had had in my office wall the 7 deadly sins, the 7 contrary virtues, and the 7 acts of charity. And so I was thinking of 7 7 7s, and then all of a sudden I look out, and there in celebration of my finishing are these 7 deer. And I said this to an audience a couple of weeks ago, and I said, I don't know, you know, it seemed like a good omen to me. And this guy in the front row, he said with a great deal of authority, he said, that was God. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, Wally Lim, thank you. Writers on a New England Stage is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio and the Music Hall in collaboration with River Run Bookstore. The executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch. New Hampshire Public Radio's president is Betsy Gardella. The NHPR broadcast producer is Keith Shields. The musical director is Bob Lohr. The house band is Dreadnought. The associate producer is Tom Holbrook. Associate producer and director of strategic communications is Margaret Talcott. Music hall production staff includes Jana Morris, Quentin Stockwell, Mike Marchand. Live sound production and engineering by Clegg Sound Associates. A very special thank you to our guest tonight, Wally Lim. Thanks a lot, Wally.
Thank you.